Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 917. This episode of the Nerdist Podcast is brought to you by Squarespace. Squarespace makes it easy to turn your idea into a new and unique website to showcase whatever you want. You're a blog or publish your content or just some pictures, sell products if you want to, services of all kinds, just a few clicks. Customize everything from look and feel to settings and products using templates that are created by world-class designers. And there's nothing to ever install, patch, or upgrade ever. Head to squarespace.com for a free trial. When you're ready to launch, use the offer code Nerdist. Save 10% off your first purchase of a website or a domain. Hey, I'm going to be... first of all, if you came to any of my shows in New York at Caroline's for New York Comedy Festival, thank you. They were super fun. And then got to go to SNL Saturday night and see Tiffany Haddish, whom I adore, is hilarious and always crushed on at midnight. Now she's a big superstar. It was so exciting. She was great. That was super fun. And now I'm back. Got a cold. Just getting over it. But I'm going to be going back to Portland in a month. So December 7 through 9, Helium in Portland with my buddy Mike Furman will be there too. So get tickets for that. I think a couple of the shows are sold out already. So go just find Helium Portland on the internet and get some tickets. Come out and see me December 7 through 9. All right. Also from the Nerdist Community Corkboard, Reddit user R.W. Reynolds 3 writes, "Hello, I'm the boyfriend or the director of Every Bunny Counts Rabbit Rescue, one of the largest rabbit rescues in the nation. They're having a fundraiser for an all-day spaying and neutering session, which requires the transport of many bunnies from central Connecticut to south New Jersey. The session is necessary because there's been a lack of support from the veterinary community with the rescue. Also, the rescue survives only on donations that provide rent for the facility, food supplies, and the high cost of veterinary care. Michelle's gone so far as to cash her retirement fund to provide the bunnies at the rescue. And the rescue and Michelle personally always takes in sick and disabled instead of putting them down. She does really great work. I see her struggle every day to help them. If you want to help raise money so these bunnies can find a forever home, go to youcaring.com and search everybunny, all one word, or everybunnycounts.com to donate. They only have a couple weeks to raise $2,000 for the spaying and neutering event. It would really make a difference. Also, Sean Devlin, been a loyal listener since episode 10. By my calculations, it's taken about 1,000 hours of Chris yelling, make a thing for me to do so. This summer, I sat down and wrote a short book called The Soul Pusher, fictional tale of death, immortals, secret societies, and body swapping, and it was super fun to write, available now on the Kindle store. Congratulations, Sean Devlin. This episode is Keith Morrison. Lydia and I are big fans of Dateline, love Keith Morrison, and, you know, and then he wanted to do the podcast, and Lydia's and my minds were both blown. Like, what? We love Keith Morrison. Are you fucking kidding me? And so Lydia was like, I got to be there and meet Keith. So Lydia was here, got to meet him. And Keith was awesome. You know, I love meeting people that I watch. I mean, the fan thing never goes away. You know, I watch shows and it's still surreal for me to meet people whose voice I hear coming out of a television all the time. People sometimes say that to me about me, and I say that about a lot of people, so never feel weird about saying it to me because I 100% understand. Keith is promoting the 26th season of Dateline NBC Fridays at 10 p.m. He was super rad, and I had him over to the house, and we did the podcast here. And I thank him for coming on. This episode of the podcast was also brought to you by Stamps.com. Holidays coming up, all right? Avoid the hassle. They're already getting long, all right? I've already seen the Christmas stuff went up before Halloween, for crap's sake. So the lines are already long. Capitalism is in full effect. Christmas presents are already being bought and sent. So just stay out of the post office. Buy and print official U.S. postage for any letter package, any class of mail using your own computer and printer. Click print mail and you're done. Stamps.com never closes 24/7. They're going to send you a digital scale that automatically calculates the exact postage, helps you decide the best class of mail based on your needs. You're going to get discounts you can't get at the post office. Bring all of the service of the U.S. Postal Service right to your fingertips. Right now, you can enjoy Stamps.com with a special offer that includes a 4-week trial plus postage and a digital scale without long-term commitments. Go to Stamps.com, click the microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in Nerdist. That's Stamps.com, enter the promo code Nerdist. Here's the Nerdist Podcast episode number 917 with Keith Morrison. Katie, roll the thing.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
these shows. You know, we watch Dateline. We watch all the investigation discovery shows.
Oh,
it's really funny because
there are a lot of them.
There's a lot of them. It's a lot of lot of shows, and you know, she'll watch the women who snapped and killed their, and she'll go, oh, here's like five things she did wrong. I'm like, well, that's upsetting.
Yeah.
That you already know how to make this
there
work.
There is a way.
No, I guess some people do get away with it. We just never hear about them.
That's exactly right.
But it seems like so many times, at least the way these stories are told, you go, well, this person wanted to get caught. I mean, how would they? Why would they use a credit card? Or why would they just stuff it under the seat of their car like a bloody rag? It just doesn't make any sense.
Oh, I know. It doesn't. But it's that old movie Double Indemnity.
Yes.
That it caught it perfectly. No matter how well you plan, 99% of the people who carry out some sort of bizarre plot like that are going to not take something into account.
Right.
Mess up somehow. Something will go wrong.
I mean, it's better just to not kill people. I think ultimately,
generally speaking,
it's probably better just to get a divorce or move to a new town.
Uh-huh.
Have you noticed any I mean, you've been at Dateline for 22 years, maybe.
Something like that, yeah.
Have you noticed any consistencies where you go, look, here's a consistent thing with all of these people?
We actually didn't do murder mysteries for the longest time. We started doing those bit by bit, gradually.
Right.
And we did more and more of them because our bosses recognized that we were getting bigger audiences than for, stories about whales. But that having been said, yes, you find you do the same story over and over again. And they're all a little different, but as What is it? History doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes, and so do crimes.
Right.
So we have done, I think we've done 6 or 7 episodes now on murder of husband by wife with using antifreeze.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Because it just, they dole it out slowly.
Slowly.
Right?
And it's like, it's just like the old arsenic treatment that Agatha Christie used to write about.
Right.
Except maybe they notice it less, man.
I guess. I don't know. But I sort of feel like, isn't that now, wouldn't that be one of the first things that a hospital would test for now, knowing that people do kill each other with antifreeze?
They actually changed the formulation of antifreeze so that it doesn't taste like sweet tea anymore.
Oh, that's... You'd think they would automatically do that.
Yeah, kind of.
Should this taste good, this toxic substance to humans, should this taste... Let's make it good. Let's make it cherry-flavored antifreeze.
That's right.
Let's make it taste delicious. When did you come down from... I know you're from Saskatchewan.
Yes.
Are you?
No.
But, whenever you... Yeah. Whenever you see someone on TV and they just have like a generally pleasant demeanor, you go, they're probably Canadian.
Yeah. There are too many of us on television.
You think that's it?
Yeah, probably, yeah.
Is it you're going to start fighting other Canadians for spots?
No, we wouldn't fight
each
other. No.
Sorry.
Please, go ahead.
Please. Sorry, but you're going to have to. I'm sorry. I'm really sorry. I mean, when did you... you grew up in Saskatchewan. At what point did you say, hey, I want to be a broadcaster?
Well, I... when all else failed, really. I was a spectacular failure academically from an early age. I think I had a good year in second grade, and after that, just, not so good. other things I enjoyed a lot. I took part in all the extracurricular activities and got into, youth parliaments and all of that kind of nonsense, but I could not study or do my homework, and I didn't do very well at school. Or wake up in time to go to classes at college. Consequently, I flunked out.
And
I needed something to do with myself. My father was a preacher.
Okay.
And, in Saskatchewan, they like to say minister because, it's not the same as,
Oh, gotcha.
Southern Baptist or anything
right.
like that. But so he encouraged me in that direction, and I thought, for 5 minutes, I thought, maybe, and... So I tried out one summer being a student minister, preaching the sermons and, conducting the services. And I even did a funeral one time.
Oh.
Yeah, and I remember, comforting this 80-year-old woman. I'm 19 or 20 year old guy. And she's actually listening to me for advice. Aww. It was terrifying. But so that ended, and I realized, no, that's not what I want to do with my life. And I was sitting bereft back at my grandfather's house, where he was kind enough to let me bunk for a while, and I was watching the evening news on television and said, you know, I could do that. So I went and asked for a job at the local radio station a day or two later, and they hired me.
It's really delivering sermons, but without the comforting part.
Yeah, pretty much.
You don't have to go, it'll be okay. You just go, here's what it is.
Yeah, and it's bad.
You
it's
deal with it bad. However you want.
That's right.
I mean, it is kind of messed up in a way that I understand the news delivers a lot of tragic. You know, it's like you said, well, murder did better than whales. People are drawn to...
They always have been.
They've always been drawn to it. They'll stop and listen if it's, you know, is everything in your house killing you? More at five. Oh, I need to find out. You know, it's fear and tragedy.
You can make a living doing those teasers.
Is Keith Morrison in your house killing you? More at five. Yeah. Why is antifreeze delicious? Uh-huh. Watch at seven. But so I think it's easy for people to get this worldview that the world is a tragic. It's nothing but tragedy, right. And it's nothing but death, and nothing but destruction.
Nothing could be farther from the truth, either. Of course,
there's a lot of really great stuff in the world at the moment.
There is good stuff in the world, yeah. And crime is down, and murder occurs less frequently than it did in 1990. That's for sure.
But I know, but if you're doing a news show and you come on and say, hey, here's the evening news. You know, it's not as bad as it. Then people would just stop watching. They would think, oh, crime is solved. Everything's fine. They would stop watching.
You know, but it's more than that, because it can't be just any crime. It isn't, in fact, about the crime. As my colleague Dennis Murphy likes to say, it's not the murder, it's the marriage. And it's these stories don't work unless they are complicated, unless there are twists and turns, unless there's a whole background you need to know about, and people get confused, mm-hmm. and, you know. So the more you can, I hate to say this, and I don't really mean it this the way it sounds. It sounds terrible, but the more you sort of throw sand in people's faces, you're going to get to the correct conclusion eventually, but it might take a little while to get there.
Right. But this trend of, you know, there's a whole channel devoted to these shows. And I remember when I was growing up, it was all scripted, and then reality shows came along, and then people started going, wait a minute. This is real, so to speak.
Yeah.
But there is a certain amount of storytelling to it. I mean, these types of shows would not exist if you just came out and blurted out all the facts. They really have arcs to them.
They do, and they have to be carefully told. And, you know, either we have a 6-act structure or a 12-act structure, or, you know, maybe 11. And that is not your typical, you know, 3-act play. But it gets split up in different ways. And you know that if you're writing Act 6, it's going to be a certain way. And mm-hmm. But Act 3 is different. You want to cover something else there. So it's you know, there's an art to it. And eventually you figure out what it is, but sometimes you stumble along the way.
Do you see yourself as sort of a neutral entity in these? I'm merely presenting you what these things are.
Yes, but, you know, it's all about storytelling, and I mostly I go for a ride while other really talented people do the hard work. So I get on airplanes and I stay in nice hotels and generally get my meals paid for by the company when I'm on the road, and, you know, it's not so bad.
So would you, if someone said, hey, what do? Would you say, well, I'm an investigative journalist?
No, I would not anymore. And there was a time when I would have said that, but I guess I'd say that I'm in the storytelling business.
Interesting.
But, you know, I do very little original reporting anymore. I'll call people up and say, would you do an interview? And if they agree, then I'll, you know, probe the living daylights out of them if I can. But, you know, I'm not kind of looking in the cracks to see what evidence I can find for this or that. That's, you know, some of these wonderful people I work with.
Sure. Well, I mean, you know, you look at someone like Charlie Rose, and Charlie
just stares people down.
I know.
And he seems to have all the information in his head, and you can't get anything by him, and he just somehow squeezes all of the information out and disarms people. But, you know, you definitely have a much more of a welcoming. It's not that Charlie's not a welcoming guy. I just mean he really gets people up against a wall, so to speak.
But I think that's because he has to. And this is partly I have the great luxury of being able to sit and talk to somebody for 3 hours sometimes, or as long as I want.
Right.
And eventually, if somebody's comfortable with you, they're going to start telling you things. Pay no attention to that, future interviewees. But no, I mean, it's... everybody does it differently. But I've never felt that you get much honesty or much candor out of people, whether it's honest or not, by trying to force them into it. But if they want to talk to you...
Sure.
If they feel like telling you their story will somehow be cathartic or be helpful for the person they're talking about or something, then they will.
Yeah. How do you... Because obviously some of these people have stories that they want to tell, but maybe stories that they don't want to tell.
Right.
Maybe they're telling a different story than what the reality of the situation is.
All the time.
And so how do you, especially when you know what's going on, what are some of the tricks in the bag for getting people to break down and kind of incriminate themselves, so to speak?
Yeah. There are people who would try to tell you that you can tell when somebody's lying, and I don't believe that. I mean, I don't believe that. I mean, the best detectives will often say, well, yeah, no, I'm not very good at it either. But what it takes is triangulation. You know, you have to talk to quite a number of people, and then eventually you understand who's lying and who's kind of not.
Yeah.
Although there is a rule. Remember when Bill Clinton was having his troubles?
Yes.
And we were still not doing all murders all the time. We were, at the time, doing a lot about Bill Clinton. Mm-hmm. But I went to do a story with an interview with a psychology professor, I think he was, in Birmingham, Alabama. And he had just written a book, Lies, 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 or something it was called. And I said to him, you know, this very question, how can you tell when people are lying? And he said, everybody lies all the time. That's how you know. And it's as a place to start, it's not bad. And that doesn't mean that you don't want to hear everything that person has to say and value it and respect it. But I'm lying to you right now because I'm just editing things in my head and trying to decide what's the best thing to say and how can I impress this guy.
Of course, yes.
Because I want Chris to think I'm smart.
Well, he already does, Keith. You don't have to do anything. But I do think that what gets really into scary territory is, you know, obviously there are people who know that they're lying.
Right.
But then there are people with, you know, borderline personality disorder or just textbook narcissists where they can't.
No.
They can't physiologically admit that they've done something wrong. So it's, you know, I didn't do this.
Those people are so much fun to talk to. Especially when they're in prison and they've been convicted and they still say, you know, I'm innocent, I didn't do this. And
right.
Pure as the driven snow and you can... that's fun.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a terrible thing to say, but talking to people who want to do that, you're never going to get the truth out of them, but you're going to get an interesting tale as they dodge and weave and try to deflect.
Right. But, you know, it's also sometimes the truth isn't very clear about what's going on. I'm sure you probably watch Making a Murderer. I'm sure.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, Brendan Dassey. What did he, you know, how does that?
I know.
I mean, but then at the same time, you know, we do have to remember that we are seeing storytelling from the point of view of the storyteller. We know that we're not seeing everything in these shows. We're not seeing every detail. Mm-hmm. We weren't at every trial. So it's very easy, and I'm certainly one of those people who's like, well, obviously the legal system was corrupt, you know, but without having been at every day of the trial, seeing every bit of evidence, seeing everything, I can't 100% say that I know for certain that there was a tremendous miscarriage of justice. It feels like there was, but I wasn't there, so I don't know.
I know. Well, there you are. And so we who were there most of the time and are able to talk to the people who shepherded it all through from beginning to end, try our best to get it right. And knowing that even in a two-hour program, which we love to do and we do a lot of them now, on a specific individual crime or situation that developed in one family, say, and you spend 2 hours trying to dissect it, seems like a lot of time.
Right.
You're using a tiny percentage of the information that you'd like to be able to use.
Sure.
You could do a whole season or five seasons on that one family.
And right.
Still not get to everything. So, yeah, it's a problem. But it's using the it's selecting the right bits that matters so much.
But how do you get I mean, because I'm sure you come into things and you might have immediate judgments of well, of course it, you know. Yeah. So how do you get past your own judgments when you really need to kind of do all the research, do all the work, make sure that you don't have your own prejudices get in the way in terms of like, well, it seems like this person did it.
Yeah. I mean, it's a conscious effort. Look, I'm not, you know, as I say, I don't know who's lying and who isn't lying half the time.
Right.
I'm working with producers who are more deeply invested in each one of these stories than I am. Mm-hmm. I'm the visiting pastor. I come in and I talk to people and they go off to the next one. You just look at somebody and you take them in as if they were your relative or something, and you really want to hear their story and just try not to pass judgment on it at all. Unless you know for sure that they're lying, and then you can go after them a little bit. But you don't even want to do that too much, because as soon as you start beating somebody up on television, it looks far worse than it really is in the conversation.
Right.
Yeah.
And have you ever had to struggle with your faith in humanity? having seen firsthand all this? I mean, I watch someone like Joe Kenda or any of the cops who, you know, do the shows, and I go, how do they have any shred of it? Well, they've seen the worst things that human beings are capable of over and over and over again. So how do they wake up every day and go, hey, the world's okay. The world's not such a terrible place.
You know, it's that's a fascinating thing, and everybody reacts differently, of course. But I did a story last season about a female detective who staunchly Catholic woman who was trying to maintain a good view of the world, to see her fellow man and woman as essentially decent people. And she was confronted with a situation where young women believed to be prostitutes kept disappearing. And most of the police departments around there kind of shoveled them off onto a shelf somewhere because they were busy with non-prostitutes. And she decided that they mattered just as much as anybody else. And so she went to work on those cases and worked so hard on them and cared about them so much that you recognize that she was a more deeply human, caring person than I was. And I was so impressed by her, by how much she cared about humanity. So maybe it depressed her some of the time, but she sure worked at trying to make things better.
Did she figure it out?
And she figured it out.
Was it one person? Was there one reason?
There were two guys, and they were, they'd go shopping for.
Oh, Jesus!
Yeah, and did really bad things to them, and then they put them on in the recycling system of Orange County, and they'd go off and be buried in landfills. So,
oh my God!
They'd never find them. They got lucky with one, and were able to go with the rest of them. But I remember one time we were standing up on the top of this mountain of garbage, and there she was, the detective. You know, we're getting a distant shot of her, but she was wearing a microphone, and I don't think she was aware that she was being recorded. We're getting this wide shot of her standing on the hill from a distance, and she's saying the rosary for each of these girls.
Oh,
and she knows that they're down there somewhere.
Oh my God.
It's amazing.
God.
Yeah.
Well, you hope that the people who are investigating these crimes are the most human, because they really, you know, in some cases they need to be, in some cases they need to be able to shut it off to do what they want to do, but to do what they need to do. But you hope they care that much.
Yes.
Because if it were your family, or if it were your, you know, significant other or friend, you need to know that someone out there cares that much in order to make it right.
Yeah. It's very impressive, because a lot of people in that line of work do feel that way. And they do work for the families and for, or work for the dead, as they'll say.
Yeah. What has surprised you the most? Is there something where you really were convinced that there was one thing going on, and then it completely became something else?
I've been more surprised by the edges of human nature, by what people are capable of, that I wouldn't have thought that they would. For example, I'm not able to describe it well enough without telling you about one of them, about a preacher in the preacher sense, mm-hmm. who was, I can't remember the name of his church, but it was a Bible-based church which believed strenuously in heaven and hell and all of the kind of old-fashioned virtues. But he got the idea partway through his ministry that he should have more than one wife, that he was intended to have two or three of them. And so he went and got a junior wife. And he and his senior wife, who reluctantly accepted the circumstances, seemed to be okay for a couple of years. And then he tired of the junior wife because she wanted to go off to college, or she wanted to make something of herself, and that's not what he wanted from her. And so he sent the senior wife and the kids off to Santa Barbara for the weekend. And then he went and rented a SUV, bought some big plastic Tupperware containers from, you know, the local container store or something, and took his junior wife out to dinner. They had Kobe steak, really expensive dinner. Took her back to the house, put her in the bathroom, killed her in the bathtub, chopped her up into tiny little bits.
Oh, my God.
Put her into these two Tupperware containers, which he put in the back of the SUV, drove out to the desert in Arizona, and buried her there under a cairn of rocks. And it wasn't discovered for years. Nobody suspected him. And nobody even really knew that he had this junior wife, except, you know, a few people around him. And eventually it was solved, and he was convicted, and he was sent away for life. And he consented to an interview before he was sent to penitentiary. In California, when you're in the penitentiary, they don't allow you to do television interviews. But when you're in jail, before you go, there's a little period of time, a week or two, where you can talk to the TV cameras, usually through glass.
Okay.
And that was the case here. So I asked him I've always been interested in theology, and I was asking him how he squared what happened with his beliefs and how he was able to, you know, deal, whether he could still feel as if he was a practicing Christian given what had happened. He said, oh, of course, yes, absolutely. And he went on to tell me that he fully expected, when he died, to meet his junior wife in heaven, and they take up where they left off with a wonderful, loving relationship.
Oh, my God. And that's how his brain justified.
There you go, yeah.
In his mind, he said, oh, this is, I'm just doing you a favor.
That's right.
Oh, my God.
This is a guy
God.
Who was giving advice to his parishioners every week. And go figure.
So when you say you have an interest in theology, as in, like, from a sociological standpoint, or just you?
Yeah,
as a,
I grew up with him. My grandfather was a minister, and my father was the eldest of 10 children, and all the boys were, all but one, I think, were preachers, ministers. And as I say, I was kind of potentially going that way for a little while. So I was interested in, I'd heard it all the time as I was growing up, and arguments about theology are pretty common in these kinds of families where people are trying to figure out what, because it's such a flexible thing.
It is, yeah, exactly.
There are like 37,000 different distinct denominations of Christianity have been formed over the centuries. But so I got really interested after this period of time in where did it all come from, and what is the sociology of it? You know, who started it? Why they started? Who continued it? What all the mechanics of the transmission of these beliefs was?
And, mm-hmm.
It's remarkable.
Well, sure. I mean, you know, I assume it probably started because humans needed a reason to, number one, feel not insignificant fleas.
Right.
And then on the other side, it's incredibly effective at controlling and herding masses of people.
Well, that's true.
To behave a certain way, to become, you know, a culture or a civilization, and, you know, where a few people benefit from the...
Yeah.
Don't learn to read. This book says you should do this. Okay, but I don't need to learn to read. No, it's fine. Just do whatever this says, and then you won't go to hell. What's hell? Yeah. Well, it's a bad place. You don't want to go there. But I can tell you how to not.
Right.
You know, at a time when in politics and science and religion we're all the same thing.
Yeah.
So it is interesting how it has evolved in our society, and how, just like you said, it is very... People personalize it in ways... Whereas, like, in this guy's case, like, oh, I interpret it this way because this benefits me. So I need, you know, it's like I just feel like so much of the time it gets used as a justification tool for what people actually want, not whatever they, you know, not what is really best for the community or religion or whatever their conception of God is. So, yeah it is really fascinating.
Yeah.
I mean, do you find that it plays a recurring theme over and over again in what you see?
Oh, yeah, all the time. And both in those, in a positive and a negative way. At the heart of every one of these major religions, it doesn't matter what it is, whether it's Christianity or Judaism or Buddhism or Islam or any of it, at the heart of these religions are some basically... loving philosophy.
Sure.
Love your neighbor as yourself. You know, the golden rule.
I mean,
it's there in all of them. It's the accoutrements that change it.
All the add-ons.
All the add-ons, yeah.
Love your neighbor. As long as they believe the same thing that you believe and look like you do. But other than that,
right?
You know, as long as that, you know, like, oh, God, guys, come on. What are we, what are we doing? I mean, it is... I know there are good parts to it. They really are. And I think as human beings, we really do need community. We really need to.
Well, and you know, as religion has declined, and as really is declining in the last... Beginning about the time that the religious right became a more of a political force in America, it was not that it, you know, came out of nowhere. It's reacting to the fact that there is a kind of a gradual shrinkage of religious belief. It's not kind of... You know, it was a country in which standard issue belief was held by 90-95% of the population.
It
was down every year, and so people are feeling kind of defensive about that. Where was I going with that?
Well, we were talking about community. We were talking about...
Oh, yeah. So they don't go to church anymore.
Right.
Well, I think they probably lose an awful lot. There's something when you go to church and you have some sort of liturgy or something... calming, which is what it is, and you're looking up at some peaked ceiling or stained glass, which is very inspirational, and you have that combination of inspirational sights, repeated mantras, the music of the choir, it will transport you and make you feel better.
Mm-hmm.
But if you don't have that, you're going to not going to have a chance to sort of, unless you go to yoga a lot or, you know. So we're missing those elements, I think.
Well, I think there are a lot of community. I mean, I think we just need communities. You know, I think there are certainly other communities or, you know.
I think we should all come and live in your house. It's
a beautiful, lovely place.
Yeah.
I mean, I definitely think there's a roommate comedy to be had.
Probably.
You move in. Keith Morrison moves in. With
somebody disappears.
My wife kills me, and then you explain it.
Uh-huh.
That's our reality show. That would be such a bummer if you're like, this happened. Does this have to happen everywhere I go? So you know,
yeah.
It's like that's why I think You know, that's why I think Jessica Fletcher was the one who was responsible for every murder in Cabot Cove.
Very true. There are these British murder mysteries that come on television. Have you seen them?
Which ones?
Oh, Masterpiece Theater.
Oh, yeah, yeah, of course. Yeah.
There's Father Brown and
right.
the doctor in Australia and thing. They're little tiny communities, and they've got a murder every week.
How's anyone left? Their turnover rate has to be extraordinary. A new person has to move in every time time someone dies.
Yeah.
But it's, you know... We see it. Are we in danger of becoming just so desensitized to this type of thing? I mean, the fact that there's a catchphrase called murder porn, where it's like people, you know, it's like we watch murder shows. And there's one in particular that I'm thinking of, and it's, I can't remember what it's called, but it's hosted by Susan Lucci, who's great. But she, you know, she does all the wraparounds. Uh-huh. And it's like, and there's all these sort of puns in them, like, you know, but this dog wasn't ready for a bone. And it's like, they go, I mean, it's entertaining, but someone really did die. Like, someone really
that's
did
always
die.
That's the problem I still have every time.
Yeah.
Because you go and meet people who are, you know, they'll suffer from grief for the rest of their lives.
Yes.
And they have consented to sit with you and surrounded by TV cameras and tell you the intimate details of their life and their grief and their... And how horrible this all was for them. And it's very true. And you know, as you're talking to them, I'm going to use this person's story to make a program other people will watch to entertain themselves.
Right.
So that's always kind of I feel sort of a funny feeling in my stomach when I start into one of these episodes. And I think what comes with that is you have to be respectful to people's grief. You have to be respectful to their families. You can't make fun of them because they're trusting you to tell their story.
Right. But you're also a news magazine show and not...
Right.
I would say Dateline definitely falls under the umbrella of entertainment. I mean, like, television is entertainment. It's distracting entertainment. However... You know, I do think there's a difference between the news magazine show and the reenactment show, and particularly, like, the reenactment show that has, like, a weird... I mean, I think Kenda is my favorite because he never romanticizes any of it.
Yeah.
You see the camera's up 6 inches from his face. I mean, like, it's right in his face.
Yeah.
And you can see the crusted over horror in his eyes.
Yeah.
And he'll say, like, I haven't gotten a full night's sleep in 40 years, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that is very respectful of what's going on, even though there's a reenactment element. But, you know, some of the reenactment ones, they just get a little hammy, and you're like, people died, come on!
What are you doing? Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And some of these guys are very, and women too, can seem, you know, really hardened by what they're doing, and you think, well, they don't have an emotional bone in their body, and then you go to their office someday or the cubicle they work in at the department, whatever it happens to be, and photographs of these victims on the wall.
Wow.
Every day they go in and look at these things.
Just to remind themselves?
Yeah, to remind themselves that there's somebody there that they're working for and they better get at it.
Oh, that's incredible.
Yeah.
That's really incredible. I mean, what is the process for how you decide, you know, which stories are going to do, what you're going to cover, how you're going to cover it?
Well, I shouldn't be revealing things like this, but the I like to say, and others don't agree with me, I don't think, that we're really doing is we're telling true versions of Agatha Christie stories. She invented the template. Or at least popularized it to the degree that she sold all these billions of books.
Mm-hmm.
And the essence of it is that you have a rather... you have a discrete number of possibilities. Somebody's been murdered. It could be this, it could be that, it could be the other. But it's not going to be something, you know, way off in Zululand that suddenly popped up and in an unexplained way killed somebody. Because, that's like a traffic accident. These things happen.
Right.
But so that storyline is kind of present in most of these news magazine crime shows. There have to be twists and turns. There have to be a certain number of possible ways this could go, whether it's a number of suspects or a number of things you're looking to solve, but not too many.
But are we, I mean, does it ever make you worried that just too many people are just too close to murdering someone at all times? I mean, I can't, it's not something I can even fathom.
No.
And I would imagine most people feel that way.
Right.
And maybe even some of the people that are on, that you cover, but something happens where they make that dreaded leap.
Yeah.
And then it just happens. Or like the guy.
Well, that's, you know, there's that. And that happens, yes. But there are these things you just scratch your head. They don't happen very often, mind you. That's, I suppose, why there's stories for us and why people are fascinated in what their fellow person is capable of. But, like, we did one. We had one on the air just the other day where this woman saw a rival coming into her her life with her the boyfriend who had kind of left her, and she was trying to get him back. And so she kind of secretly killed the woman.
Jeez.
And then assumed her personality online and kept that facade going for 3 years.
Holy
crap. Before they finally figured out that the person she had killed was dead and that she was doing the impersonating.
Oh, my God.
Meanwhile, she got the guy back because she, by impersonating this dead woman, was able to harass both herself and her ex-boyfriend, and they had something to share, and they got back together again.
That is, I mean,
so,
that's a very complex, there's a lot of complexity in that. And you, I guess you would think, you know, I always marvel at people who've gotten away with something for a long time and then they get caught. You after like a year or two, you probably just think, well, I guess that's fine now. Because you would just get comfortable, right? Or do you think there's always
something...
Do you think there's always something in the back of their head that's like, someone's going to find out, someone's going to find out?
Well, yeah, and that was, I think, what the issue was there. But, I mean, she went to the extent of making herself look innocent by having this fictional person burn her house down with her pets inside.
Oh, my God.
Killed her pets.
God.
She shot herself through the leg to make herself look innocent, and somebody else looked
How'd they figure it out?
Well, in the end... Yeah, technology undoes all of us.
Sure, sure. Okay, so, yeah. Gotcha. Yeah, I mean, when you the fascinating thing about the Kenda cases is that this you know he was there in the 70s or the early 90s,
right?
And there was you know even DNA testing wasn't really reliable until kind of near the end of his tenure. But
yeah.
But now you know, do we feel better as a civilization because it's harder and harder and harder to get away with these things?
I hope so. I mean, it is hard to get away with these things now, and people get caught. But again, let me repeat, this doesn't happen very often.
Right.
It's not a less safe world than it used to be a generation ago. And nowadays, not as many mistakes are being made by law enforcement and by the courts because there is, you know, there's more of that kind of technological evidence available than there ever was before.
Sure. Yeah, a guy that I knew who was an entertainment reporter said he used to, when he first started, he covered the crime beat for the Los Angeles Times, I think. And I said, oh my God, that must have been crazy. Did you have trouble sleeping at night? And he goes, no, it was the opposite. Because he said, what I learned was that in the cases of murder, an astonishingly high number, he said 7 or 8 times out of 10, it was not random.
Yeah.
Though it seemed random by looking at the superficial qualities of the crime, when they would dig a little deeper, they would find this person knew this person. There was a connection.
Oh, yes.
And he said it actually made me feel a lot safer that I wasn't just going to randomly get murdered on the streets of Los Angeles, which, you know, people think of a big city like L.A., like, oh, it must be crime-ridden. He was like, it was actually
not
as crazy as you might think.
No, this guy in Las Vegas is a unicorn. I mean, that just never happens. So, as everybody is talking about.
But it doesn't
happen on smaller scales either.
They still haven't been able to pinpoint what his motivation was. And that you know, when these types of tragedies happen, I'm always torn about, don't publish the guy's name and his picture because it just, glorifies, you know, and there's going to be someone else out there that's going to see that and copycat it. And we can't. But at the same time, it is important to figure out who these people are and try to understand so that we can prevent these types of things in the future.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's you're right. It's a push-pull with a thing like that. I always feel the same way. And whenever there's a terrorist incident or something, I want to say, stop it, for God's sake. Don't go live on television all the time. That's
right.
What they want.
Right.
Or this guy who, I guess he was a minister, the guy that took the cough medicine and killed his wife in the middle of the night.
Oh.
And said he, this just happened like a month ago.
Okay.
He said he woke up and he had blood all over himself and his wife was dead on the floor. And he said, well, I took this cough medicine and maybe I took more than I should have and I didn't know, you know.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. I mean, it just seems like, you know, how do you know what to believe? I would never, I mean, I think being a juror, as much as we all, you know, when you get the jury duty summoned, you go, oh, I got to go. I mean, I have so much respect for people who actually are able to do it because the amount of information that they see, because it feels like, and I'm not to disparage the court systems, but in a lot of cases, it almost kind of seems like the point of a trial is not necessarily to find out the truth, but there's a justice pong between the defense and the prosecution.
That's a good way to put it. I worry about that too. Well, I'm an outsider looking in, but sometimes when you talk to jurors and look at the facts of the case, you think, how the heck did they come to that conclusion?
Right.
It doesn't make any sense at all.
Right.
But there you go.
Or hearing that something, this isn't admissible. I know, but it proves that this person didn't do that thing. Well, but it's not, you can't consider it. But aren't we trying to find out the truth? Well, no.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe not. I remember, may I bore you with an old story?
Please, go right ahead.
So there was this guy, his name was Billy Wayne. His case is now taught in some law schools in the East. But he was a very poor man, very overweight, who had a wife and three little girls. They lived in a poor part of a town in South Carolina. And they were not good housekeepers at all. In fact, the kids had been taken away from them once because they were so bad, and eventually they got the kids back again. So he didn't have the best reputation in the world, but he was a sweet man. And one night, something happened at his house. He woke up in the morning and couldn't hear his daughter, so he went to check on her, and she was in bed, dead. And he went and called 911. He was a guy with a kind of a flat affect anyway, and the police decided he must be guilty, must have killed her. She was sexually assaulted as well. So they questioned him they questioned him on audio tape. During the time it was on audio tape, he denied killing his daughter, something like the defense attorneys used the word 666 times, but it was something around that many times.
Yeah.
Until eventually he wasn't the brightest bulb, and they wore him down. And after 4 days of this, he confessed that he killed her, that he did it. They, you know, gave him a story that he could, you know, get his head around, I guess. And he not only did that, he wrote it down, signed it, and then he did a video presentation, went to his house, and he showed how he choked his daughter and killed her. The only problem was that none of the things in his confession matched any of the facts in the case, so it couldn't possibly have been true. However, he was charged with first-degree murder, and he immediately became the most hated man in this town. About a few weeks later, another man was arrested who had been doing some robberies and sexual assaults in the area ever since he was released from prison a few weeks before this girl was killed. And they tested his DNA. By this time, you know, the Billy Wayne was already, you know, on his way to trial. They tested the DNA of this other guy and discovered he's the one who did it. It's his DNA on this little girl. But instead of charging the other guy, they charged them both with conspiracy to do it together.
Oh, because my gosh.
The dad was in the house. He must have heard. Well, there's no reason why he should have heard necessarily, but So eventually, they're both convicted by a jury of conspiracy to commit murder. But the father was given, you know, a kind of a harsher... The sentences were both harsh, but the father was like the devil. And the jury, when I interviewed them, and you're going over these things, well, how do you get around this problem and that problem and the other problem? And one of the jurors, having refused to answer a number of questions, said, well, you know, they were, this father was a very religious man, and his daughter, who he killed, was a very religious girl. And they, that church is very much against homosexuality. And we decided this guy who came to see him in the middle of the night was probably a homosexual.
What?
And they were having some sort of homosexual liaison, and the daughter woke up and discovered them, and they decided they had to kill the daughter so that she wouldn't report what they had done.
How did they get that? Was that any presented in the evidence anywhere?
No.
Jesus. That's terrifying.
Yeah.
That
now, I don't think the whole jury, you know, came to that conclusion. Most of them wouldn't talk to us. But this one particular person, that was his thought.
Oh, good Lord. Well, that is, I mean, I don't even know how to wrap my brain around that. So is the guy still, was he still in jail?
He died a few years ago. It was a sad story. He went to jail. He became a minister in jail, and he actually didn't have such a bad life there. Although, you know, his wife died, his children never spoke to him again. It was tragic.
So all of the evidence would suggest that he just slept through the whole thing, had nothing to do with
it. He wore a CPAP mask in the days when those made a lot of noise.
Sure.
He was in a small house, but he's in one bedroom. The daughter who was killed was in a bedroom probably 10 to 15 feet away from his door, was her door. The little girls had their own separate bedroom right next door to the other daughter's bedroom. They didn't wake up. He with the CPAP machine on, I don't see why he would have wakened up, but and he didn't.
Right.
And you know, it was only in the morning that he discovered what happened.
So when you hear a story like this, or whether you're covering it or not, do you feel a sense of anything to go, well, I have to shine the light on this injustice?
Yes, yes. There was a period of time where I got really interested in these kinds of stories and in what appeared to me to be false convictions, and which, I mean, I'm not going on my own. There are Innocence Project attorneys all around the country working on these kinds of cases. And some of the more celebrated ones are stories we have done. But most of the people involved in them still spent years and years and years in prison. Some of them are still there. I think about those people all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, because just like in the Making a Murderer case,
right,
the nephew... Did you do this? I didn't do this. Come on, you did this. I didn't do that. You know, and he, you know, unfortunately didn't have the complete faculties
It's a classic case.
Classic case where in his mind he says, so if I tell you this, you're just going to let me go?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, you can go home.
Sure.
Okay, fine. I did it. He did it. He says he did it.
Yeah.
I'm like, well, you just...
I know.
What do you think?
We did a piece once with a well-known detective in England who... was part of a program where they had changed the law there, changed the rules, because they were having some problems with false confessions, where previously, as is the case in this country, the detective can lie. It's perfectly fine. You can say, you know, I just talked to your friend who...
Right.
And he just flipped on you. He said you did it, and he had nothing to do with it. And what are you supposed to think?
Right.
But that is a complete fabrication. But you can do that, and you can do a whole bunch of other things. You know, you can put somebody in a corner. You can crank up the heat to 95 or make it really cold. You can, two big guys can be kind of facing in on you, you know, giving you that policeman stare,
right,
for a long, long, long time, as long as they want, with no supervision, as long as you don't invoke Miranda. Anyway, you get false confessions. So In Britain and in most other countries now, they've changed the rules where you can't lie, where everything has to be recorded on video and audio, and it's got to be good quality video where you can see the person's face.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see the detective's face. And there has to be a lawyer present. And it can only go a certain period of time. Like, you can only have an hour and a half at each interrogation. And you can't keep them in a jail cell for days and days and days while this goes on. So the police, the detectives and so on, felt that they rebelled against this. They thought, we'll never solve a crime again. But their clearance rate has gone up by something like 20% so they're solving more crimes since this went into effect.
Why is that?
Because they had to change their method of investigation. So they would do pretty much what people like me do. They'd go and talk to somebody. They'd get their story. The story's on the record. Then you can go check the story against the other evidence you're able to find. And where the two disagree, that's a demonstrable situation where your person is now committed a felony, in essence. It's lied to a police officer. You are able to work with that and eventually come to a better conclusion, in their view, anyway.
That's really interesting. Yeah. I mean, I'm glad it works that way, because I would imagine, if you sit someone down and you go, your friend turned on you, or this, I mean, all the kind of Law and Order stuff that you see.
Right.
You know, of course I go, I didn't, he wanted to, it just.
Sure.
What do you think the percentage of false convictions is? You know, like, what do you think?
Oh, God, I don't know. But, you know, I, the experts of this will say that probably, you know, if there are 2 million people in prison every night in America, maybe, you know, at least 2-3% of them are innocent of any crime. So how many people is that? I don't know.
Well, yeah, then it'd be like 40,000-50,000 people.
Yeah.
Good Lord. That's crazy. But but this is the justice system that we have. And the hope is that, hopefully it nets favorably for.
Well, it does pretty well. I don't know though whether I would pick a jury or a judge if I had the choice.
You mean to be a juror or a judge?
No. If I were charged with something.
Oh, gotcha.
Would I want a jury? The problem is they don't get to hear the whole story.
No, they don't get to hear the whole story, and so much of it is how well their attorney can manipulate the emotions of those people who are being paid $5 a day or whatever it is, and who are having to sit in one place and focus for 8 hours.
Right.
And really, I mean, you know, you hope that your peers are all responsible citizens, but, you know, but then you interview this guy who is convinced of this crazy story of the...
I know, it's... Who knows? I mean, that was an outrageous example, but still.
What do you do for fun? When you're doing it, you do this, your job is very serious. Your job is very serious.
No, I love this job. I would do this job for free. Don't let my...
Don't, that's recorded now.
Yeah. But no, it's who knew? I had to be dragged into this. I thought it was awful doing this. I ran up against that. Here we are telling people's personal tragedies as a form of entertainment.
Right.
Very early and often. And I didn't want to do it. It took a long time to kind of get to that point. But now, I mean, there is a way we can serve their interests, and the stories are so damned interesting. You just can't not cover them.
Well, sure. And you're able to shine a light onto people that would otherwise...
Well, yeah. But you get into them. A story about politics or other stuff I used to do, a fire or a whatever. I mean, they're just... You recite some facts and go home. Here, man, you can't stop thinking about it.
I sort of feel like covering politics now is almost...
Well, maybe. I used to say that, but I can't anymore.
No, it's crazy. I remember covering politics is crazy right now. It's such a volatile time. I mean, you know, we're in such an era where people... We're just in, like... Everyone just shouts, you know? It's like, I feel like there was a time where even if people didn't agree... They might argue, but they might still go, well, I don't know. You're a person. I'm a person. You know, Now it's just, if you don't agree with me 100%, you're the worst person in the world. And I'm going to yell at you, and I'm going to get in your face and say any horrible thing I can.
Yeah.
I mean, when you sort of look at all this and you look at all the stories that you cover and you look at where we're at now, you know, like where can we find our shreds of humanity again? Where do we find our humanity?
Yeah, good. You see, the problem is, I think we're creatures of our tools, right?
Sure.
We have the internet, we have iPhones and devices where we can, you know, rant at somebody at a moment's notice.
Right,
and
right,
we can feel like we're anonymous as we do it, whether we are or not. But so it creates such a climate that we're different creatures now than we used to be a couple of generations ago. You can't get that back. It's gone forever.
I know. Well, there are the entities that we portray to the world, you know, these digital representations of who we want the world to think we are.
Yeah.
And then who we really are. You know, I mean, the extreme cases are obviously posing as someone that you've murdered for 3 years, but, you know, the common case is this posting this sort of Matrix-style idealized versions of ourselves so that people think we're all cool and we're all woke and we're all just super well-adjusted. And we're all messed up.
Truly. Yeah, we are. We certainly are, aren't we? Yeah.
I'm sure people have asked you a million times, but you must have seen the Bill Hader thing. Was it delightful to you, or were you like, what an asshole?
No, it was horrifically embarrassing for about 5 minutes, and I thought, well, wait a minute, this is pretty cool.
Okay, good.
Very funny. Yeah. And he, I've never met him, but everybody tells me what a nice guy he is.
Such a sweetheart. I think I read something where he said, you know, because of NBC, he was like, he was really terrified he was going to get in an elevator with you at NBC and have to be like, hey, I was just, I mean, you know.
No, I used to think it probably is true that I owe him a percentage of my income or something.
Well, I feel like, you know, there are two types of impressions that people can do. There's, you know, like what Baldwin is doing with Trump, which is like, I want to ridicule this guy.
Yeah.
But then there are other types of impressions where I really feel like he's a real fan. He's a real fan of yours because, it's to create a caricaturization of someone, you really have to pay attention to them.
Sure. But I understand also that I am, and maybe most people are, but I know I am faintly ridiculous, and that's okay. I don't mind being that.
What do you think you're ridiculous for?
Just a funny way I talk or something. I don't know. Doesn't matter.
Well, you know what it is? There's a real, like, you know, knowing that you grew up in Saskatchewan, there's a real sort of like, pull up a chair, let's have a conversation. I mean, it's like, and that's different than the, this is the hard-hitting new, you know, there's a certain cadence.
Right.
And it happens in every form of entertainment where, you know, when Howard Stern became popular, a bunch of guys started sounding like Stern.
Yep.
When E! Became popular, a bunch of entertainment reporters all started talking like this. Like, there's one, like, patient zero that just infects all the cadence. But
I like to think of it as it's pottery styles. You know, if you're an archaeologist, you go back and look at ancient civilizations, and you know that something happened in the year 380 B.C. as opposed to 360 B.C. because the pottery is different. Over 20 years, thousands of years ago, you can tell the difference of 10 or 15 or 20 years.
Yeah.
It's the same with the way people talk. It's the same with the way they behave.
Right.
You know, some archaeologists could come back and listen to this conversation and know that it was 2000, what the hell is it now?
17.
Yeah, there you go.
2017. Yeah. But I think, but your style is so, I don't know how to describe it. It's comforting. I mean, it's not, it doesn't feel presentational in that way. It almost, you know what it feels like? It almost feels like, all right, you're going to hear about some bad things, but the good news is that uncle you like is going to tell you all those things. So it's going to, it's somehow going to make it okay so that you don't feel like you're just dropped into a bucket of ice, you know, when you're hearing about
glad to hear that. Thank
well, this is, I mean, the material present is not easy material to present. It's not, it's people's lives are at stake. It's the worst things that have happened. You know, hearing you describe these cases has to be done with a certain respect and delicately. Yeah. And so it's not, of all the jobs in entertainment, that's one where I sort of feel like, well, I don't know if I could do, I don't know how you're able to do that in a way that presents it respectfully, but also these are the facts, and I'm not, you know, I'm trying to present them. I mean, it's there's a real balancing act to it. Do you think that came from covering politics, or is that just a part of your personality?
I don't claim credit for that. I think most people who do this sort of thing recognize where the boundaries are, and you know, you want to be respectful of the, especially this kind of material.
Yeah.
Yeah. I see politics, covering politics now is just, I want to tear my hair out.
It's beautiful hair, by the way. I mean, you're one of the lucky ones. You know, you're one of the lucky ones. That is a gorgeous head of hair.
Very kind. Thank you. Extremely white.
It is, but yeah. It's authoritative, but it's got a nice wave to it.
Like it's I worry sometimes that it's beginning to look Trumpian.
No.
Okay, good.
No. All
right.
No, because it doesn't.
Not that there's anything wrong with that. Understand, but I just wouldn't want.
No. Well, there is something wrong with it. But it doesn't have that dramatic swoop. It just sort of feels like, you know, I don't know.
How does he do that anyway?
I don't know. Yeah. I don't know if it's just like so long in the front that it just swoops.
Yeah, and it's really short along the.
Yeah.
It's strange, isn't it?
I don't really know how it is. I kind of wonder.
And how does it stay that way if it's windy or something?
I don't know. It must be either some type of composite material.
Could be.
Or, you know, maybe every morning they just drive him around and he holds his head out the window and it just like blows in a certain way. And then when it just settles back down, that's what it is.
Is it less orange now than it used to be?
I think it is. It's probably going a little grayer.
Or just more kind of blonde with a little gray maybe.
I mean, he's been playing a lot of golf. So
that's true.
So, you know, maybe more golf than before he was president. So maybe he's out in the sun more. He's out in the sun, you know.
See, now this is a way of covering politics. I'm not sure it's a good way, but there it is.
Well, we're not really talking about anything actually political. We're just talking about how we are fascinated as hair enthusiasts.
Yes,
how
exactly
how that is possible.
Yeah.
Purely for science.
Yeah.
It's a scientific study that we're doing.
It's damned impressive.
Where do you think the responsibility of the news media, like, what's the line of demarcation between, all right, this is responsibly covering something and, all right, that's exploitative? I mean, I remember maybe 15 years ago or so, 15, 20 years ago, they were still completing the 105 freeway in Los Angeles.
Okay.
And a guy, there was a high-speed car chase. They covered it all.
Oh, all right.
We're live.
Yep.
You know, guy gets out of the car, you know, shoots himself, and it's live on the news in the afternoon. Of course, afterwards, you know, there was somewhat a pile. We're very sorry we showed this. This tragedy should not have been shown, but remember, it shouldn't have been shown here first on Action News. You know, like they apologize, but we're really sorry.
Oh, yeah.
What do you think the line is between the responsibility to deliver the news versus, now this is just exploitative?
Well, I come from Canadian television. I spent the first 25 years of my career there.
Yep.
And when I came here, I thought everything was exploitative. And
That's a fair point.
It's vastly different than it was where I came from. Well, now they've kind of evened out a little bit, I think.
Sure.
Was it Hunter S. Thompson? Mm-hmm. The television business is a cruel money trench, you know that expression? Long plastic hallway where thieves and pimps run free and good men die like dogs.
That's a good Hunter S. Thompson.
Yeah. But, I mean, it's all about, it's about making money for the people who own these places. And those of us who work there like to think that we're journalists. And so we're going to tell a true story. And that's crucially important for us. And making money is crucially important for them.
Right.
But the line changes all the time. It depends on where you work, who you work for, how desperate they are, you know. It just changes all the time.
It's interesting to hear that you worked for 25 years before you came to this country.
Yeah.
And then you've been at Dateline for almost 25 years.
I started in broadcasting in September of 1967.
Oh, my gosh.
50 years ago. Yeah.
But that was what an incredible time that was, too, for political change and cultural change.
Sure it was.
I mean, at that time, were people saying the same thing like, the world's going to shit, we're all going to, you know.
Well, it was going to shit, pardon my expression.
No, please. But, it's all right.
Yeah, it was not great, right? People getting assassinated, wars started that shouldn't have been started. Oh, man.
But we survived.
Yeah. Although, yeah. Can you imagine what the world would be like if that mistake hadn't been made, if we hadn't gone to Vietnam?
I mean, I can't. I mean,
who knows, right?
Who knows? I mean, it is the sort of a, if you undo one thing,
right?
What are the net consequences of everything?
That's, the butterfly effect.
The butterfly effect. Yeah, the butterfly effect. But I mean, at that time.
At that time, it was.
Is that mostly what you were covering?
No, I was Canadian. Remember, I was in Saskatchewan.
Well, there might be a maple shortage this year, you guys.
Yeah, didn't have maple there. I'd go down to the city hall and see what they were doing there. It was a starting out job. You know, I'd go to magistrate's court and come back and write a story about some poor kid who was convicted of dangerous driving or something. And
so what made you decide to come to America after 25 years?
Oh, you know, I was going along happily. I was doing political documentaries. I mean, just turgid compared with what you wouldn't get them on the air in this country. And we were only doing it in that country because it was a government-supported network.
Sure.
That decided it was important to tell these kinds of stories, even if nobody wanted to watch them. So I was a guy who did those sorts of things. And I, just out of the blue one day, I got a call from Los Angeles. You want to come and be an anchor on this private station in Los Angeles? And I think I was at a place where I didn't know what the next step was, but I know I wanted to take some step, and maybe I was tired of documentaries about politics. And I thought, what the hell? I'll just have a sabbatical. I figured I'd come down and try this for a couple of years, and I'm still here.
I mean, it must be, you know, to see what you've accomplished. You know, at that time, 25 years in, you probably figure like, well, I don't know, I've probably done. I mean, are you thinking like, I've probably done everything. I mean, I might like to do some other stuff, but who knows?
As I recall that very day that this happened, a producer and I had been doing a story about some serious pollution problem in a town called Sarnia. And they called it the Blob. And the Blob had kind of taken over the river there. And it was a crisis. They were trying to sort it out. So he and I were sitting in a kind of down market hotel, Motor Inn, having dinner and talking about how, okay, well, I guess we're lifers at the CBC now. This is just where we'll spend the rest of our careers. And I got called to the phone. And it was, you know, the guy had persistently tried to find me, and they found me at this hotel.
But I guess
it was odd, to say the least.
Yeah, but it also, you know, if you're willing to stay in the game long enough, you just never know.
Yeah.
You just never know.
No, it's true.
Is there anything you want to plug or promote or anything you want to, you know?
Well, I like it when people watch Dateline.
Yeah?
I do.
That's good.
And I like it when they tweet.
How did you even know about this podcast? Like when they said, Keith, do you want to have Keith Morrison on the podcast? I'm like, yes! I would have asked, but I wouldn't have thought you'd want to do it.
No. Al Gore was on your podcast.
It's true. He was.
Yeah, he was. God, he's got an amazing voice.
He does have an amazing voice.
Rich, deep. It just rolls out like, I don't know, butter.
I still feel bad. You know, I feel bad. I kind of went. I'm not a journalist. I'm just a guy who likes to have conversations with people. But I was fascinated by Al because, you know, the smallest percentage of humans have experienced what he's experienced, going through a presidential race.
Right.
And I was really curious to know, like, what happens, you know, when you put all this you put all this energy into something and it doesn't work out and you question the results.
Right. He didn't answer your question.
He didn't answer it.
No.
And, you know,
he's been asked that question lots of times, but probably not as in an interesting way as you did.
Well, I was really trying to understand the humanity behind it because how do you, you know, my point being, you know, you've picked up and you've still, you know, you've gone on to do a million other things. Yeah. And just for people who feel like they've been kicked in the gut by the thing that they really, really want, like, how do you get up? And the only thing he said was like, "Oh, you're bringing up some PTSD here." But what I realized is that having a conversation with a politician is a lot different than talking to an actor.
Pivot.
Yeah, he's really amazing at it. Yeah. I mean, really amazing at it. But I'm also not, because I'm not a journalist, I'm not going to go, "Focus, answer my question." I'm going to be like, "Okay, well, he doesn't want to talk about it, so I'm not going to make him talk about it."
Well, right.
But do you have any, maybe I'm just mining you for tools, when you talk to someone...
You won't find very many here.
But when you can't get someone, when you can't get that thing that you're aiming for, and I don't do it very often, but when you can't get that thing that you're aiming for out of someone, is there sort of a go-to, or do you just go, "Hey, you know what? They don't want to talk about this. I'm going to let it go." Or do you just...
You know, the thing was with that, I listened to that interview, and you have the luxury of an hour with somebody, but you don't have the luxury of 4 hours to reduce into that one. So if I were in your position, I would have just circled back, circling back until finally something came out.
Oh, that's great.
But when you have to, because I did a morning show one time. You got 4 minutes. You got to get somebody's deepest thoughts in 4 minutes. It's not going to happen.
And promote the thing that they
want to promote. And
promote
the thing they want to promote.
But,
You hit it hard and you miss the mark 90% of the time. But if you've got all the time in the world, you know, this wouldn't have been possible if in the old film days. That's when I started, and you had an absolute maximum for any interview you wanted to do of 10 minutes.
Oh, my gosh.
And because that's how much film was on the roll.
Oh, my gosh. You were hobbled by technology.
So you could never have a Dateline in 1975. It just wouldn't have happened.
Unbelievable. Yeah. I mean, just the evolution of media, and even the medium of podcasting, I find so, really impactful in the landscape of, you know, when at one other time in history could you have this much long-form content about literally anything you would want to know or learn about or hear about or humanize people that you see?
I like to think I've got, you know, a wonderful job, but I got to say, yours is not so bad.
You could easily do a podcast, by the way. No, you don't think so? Think about it.
Yeah.
I think you can think about it.
All right, I'll think about it.
All right. It was such an honor to meet you. I mean, when I told my wife you were going to the book, she was like, "I have to say hi." Like, she, you know. I mean, we legitimately watch you quite a bit.
Well, when she said she had some plans afoot for you.
Yeah.
I guess
it's good that we get this on record now so that you can cover the story. And when you cover the story of my murder at the hands of my wife, you can replay the footage of you talking to her. That's very Inception level.
I know.
I mean, the ratings would be amazing.
They would be.
All right.
I'm assuming you've got cameras everywhere.
We do have cameras. My wife would, you know, make sure to do it in front of the, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Just to make sure that it was all recorded. Yeah. So, well, I appreciate that. Keith Morrison, it was an honor to meet you, and thank you so much for coming to the house.
It's been an honor to be here.
Excellent. Thank you so much. We end the podcast by telling our listeners to enjoy their burrito. It just means enjoy your present. Don't live in the past or the future. Enjoy your experience. Enjoy the process as it's happening. Would you mind signing us off and just telling the listeners to enjoy their burrito?
Really? Enjoy your burrito.
That's it?
Yeah. Well, enjoy your burrito then.
The best. Thank you so much. The end.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
This episode of the Nerdist Podcast is brought to you by HBO's Night of Too Many Stars, America Unites for Autism program. Jon Stewart's going to return to host. This is, of course, a live comedy benefit on HBO, presented in partnership with Next for Autism. It's an all-star event featuring stand-up performances, sketches, short films by some of Hollywood's biggest stars, airing Saturday, November 18th at 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, only on HBO.